wait a second till your friends are all settled.
Of course.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Ed Gleason. I represent the appellants, in this case the union, and its pilots, of course. Your Honor, we're here on an appeal from the grant of an injunction issued by Judge Moss last fall. We're here on appeal because we think that, and our point that we'd like to discuss with you today, is the trial court made, I think, several legal mistakes and misapplied very well settled law in determining that it did indeed have even jurisdiction to grant such an injunction. And I'd like to discuss, both sides have very extensively filed papers and argued this in a lot of paper, a lot of trees. But the thing I'd like to really focus on this morning, Your Honors, is to go back to Shoreline. Let's go back to the analysis that actually is required here to determine whether there was indeed a status quo violation in the first place. This is a case where, although the carriers actually identified or purported to identify dozens of examples of actual conduct, behavior as they call, that violated what they call the status quo, they never really got around to defining in any discernible way what the status quo was. This isn't a case where the carriers conceded that there is no violation of the collective agreement. They didn't proceed on a basis that there was any violation at all of the collective agreement or even, therefore, best practices under that. They instead, at trial, they claimed that this is only an RLA Section 2 first, therefore implied status quo case. That does not negate or eliminate their obligation to point out to the court what precisely is the status quo that they're saying was changed. In this case, they hinged their status quo claims simply on claims of change in behavior. Behavior alone does not make a RLA practice or condition under the Shoreline decision. The Shoreline decision still requires that even in a case where you concede that there's no violation of a specific term in the collective agreement, you still have to find a practice or a working condition that's actual, and it has to be actual and objective conditions such that they're deemed to be an implied term as if they're part of the collective agreement. To therefore be an RLA Section 6 status quo or practice, that has to be something, again, that's clear. It has to be something that's based upon and determined based upon mutuality, acquiescence.
What's your argument with respect to the blockout? There are three things we're talking about.
Yes.
What are the contractual obligations? What are the legal obligations with respect to blocking out?
The blocking out, or it's been referred to as the boot program. The company, we think it's, quite bluntly, we think it was an absurd claim even that could ever constitute a status quo. Contractually, we have a responsibility to show up and work and report for duty and to fly our airplanes and to do that pursuant to company policy.
Somewhere that a pilot has, once ready, must leave even if it's before the time?
No, not at all. The company made a bold claim that there is such a metric as loaded and ready. There's not at all any metric like that anywhere. In fact, to the contrary, in the company's policy manuals, they actually have a requirement that you cannot depart earlier than the estimated time of departure any earlier than 15 minutes from that. And so Judge Moss even determined that it was a violation, determined that to the extent there was any behavioral activity pre-Section 6, it included even 25 minutes. It's not the appropriate analysis. There is no metric whatsoever, whether it be by these carriers or any other carrier that I'm aware of, that has a loaded and ready policy or procedure. And certainly in here, there was never, ever any metric, certainly that could rise ever to the level of a status quo practice even, that there's such behavior could actually be enjoined now that we're in a Section 6 period. It's just not there.
I'm not entirely sure what the injunction would do, for example, with respect to that. What's being, I'll ask the other side, in your view, what's being enjoined? If there's no requirement anywhere, contractual, federal regs, as far as I know, the regs simply talk about leaving on time, as far as I recall, right?
No, I agree with you, Your Honor. There is
federal regs don't say once you're ready, you can leave before on time.
I'm not aware of any federal reg that says that, and the only metrics I am aware of, and I think it's also just by the regulatory authorities at specific airports, is, you know, when you get there, you have slot times, and for instance, like that, when you can arrive and things like that. But the real metric has always been one of arrival time, are you late or not? This is not a slowdown case simply because we left less early than what they claimed that we did previously to Section 6.
What do you think the injunction requires the pilots to do with respect to blocking out? What does that mean?
I think, ironically, I guess the converse would be true. We shouldn't block out on time. I mean, that's really how bizarre that I think that entire claim was. Our behavior was that the pilots, they have discretion. It's part of their job, obviously, as pilots licensed. Pilots have discretion to determine when it's safe, when it's appropriate, and when they are indeed ready to fly. But they're also subject to the restrictions of, you know, the 15-minute restriction, like I said before. But to say simply because they left, let's say, 20 minutes earlier than the Section 6, that then now they're required to do it in every instance or risk contempt, now that there's an injunction issued, that's a worrisome prospect for my client and for my client's pilots. So
accepting the overtime, you know, you put on some decent evidence to suggest there's a clear explanation as to why the pilots were unwilling, because what the company was offering had changed. The company's burden, not your burden, the company's burden to get the injunction to show that, in fact, there'd been a change in the status quo with respect to overtime. Your claim is that what the company was offering was different, and therefore it's perfectly reasonable that what you saw from the pilots changed, and indeed it was inconsistent what you saw from the pilots. What do you think is their best case with respect to the overtime? I mean, it's clear to me what you put in, and I understand what you put in. What do you think is the best case that they're putting in with respect to change of status quo?
I think the carrier's best case has always hinged upon the statistical analysis, just simply determined on what past behavior based upon prior on circumstances that have indeed changed.
But the statistical analysis, if I'm understanding you correctly, does not incorporate an understanding or an attempt to digest the change in what's being offered.
That's correct, and I think that the use of statistical analysis in here was a mistake by the court. And it's
I mean, and I'll ask them the same thing. The raw numbers don't mean a thing if what the pilots are being offered is not the same as it was before. And indeed, am I right with respect to the overtime that what you saw was actually fluctuating? And indeed, there was 1 month, which was during a holiday period, the overtime acceptance rate was not down.
Yeah, it's correct, Your Honor. It was actually statistical gymnastics is perhaps a generous way to, you know, from our perspective as to what took place here. The statistics that were used in order that certainly persuaded Judge Moss were not consistently even applied, and they frankly dealt with wholly new, made up for specifically for this case metrics.
All right. So what they're trying to and what the trial judge was buying was the kind of ha-ha messages going between union leadership and members, as if to suggest, you know, we got some leverage here. And I'm really not sure what to do with it in my mind, because I don't know that they're making out the case. But on the other hand, there are cases that say, or seem to suggest, when there are these ha-ha messages, you know, kind of give it to them, you know, then you're in a less good position than you would otherwise be.
We can't run away from the communications that you know are in the record, Your Honor, and we don't. But we do think that those communications were taken clearly out of context and used for the wrong reason to shore up the.
Let me ask you for that. I mean, you agree, don't you, that if there is evidence of a concerted effort that the union orchestrated a concerted slowdown to create pressure on the ongoing negotiations, that is a major dispute, if one can find it. That's what you're looking for, right? That's
well, Your Honor, I would have to nuance that one extra step. There would also have to be discernible, demonstrable harm. Like, okay. For instance,
Wait. Let me make sure we're joining this carefully.
Sorry.
What Judge Griffith asks you leaves out the inquiry about change in status quo.
Yes. That's
that
correct.
Part of your answer?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I was going to...
You're saying you can be as concerted as you want it, but if there's no change in the status quo, there's no failure.
You still have to find, is there a status quo within the meaning of the RLA and the shoreline and its progeny? Was there a change in that status quo?
Your answer to the ha-ha.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, that's part of the answer.
Like, whatever, there's no change in the status quo.
Yeah. Yeah.
The overtime is an easy explanation. I don't know, the blocking out, I'll have to hear what the company's saying. That one is baffling to me. I don't know what that means. I don't know what the status quo is there. And on the sick leave, I don't know how you put it in a status quo if every single case that they're citing, there's an explanation for the person's absence.
Which we demonstrated each and every instance, not just of the sick leave, examples of what they called abuse, as well as the fatigue, which
my understanding of your evidence is every absence or call-in was explained, and the company's not contesting that it was legitimate.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the company conceded that.
I'll have to ask them, but your answer to Judge Griffith is it's not just a notion of concerted activity. There's got to be a change in the status quo.
Yes, and at the end, yes, and there also has to still be, even if you get to that next point, the last step at the back end, if you will, there's supposed to be a discernible harm. This case deals with, it boils down to, if we plow through more than 140 pages of very detailed statistical analysis from the carrier's expert, boils down to what the carriers have described as on average, 6 minutes and 18 seconds worth of departure delay. That's why we're here.
What is wrong with the following sequence? Tell me where you get off the plane. The union mounted a slowdown campaign and persistently directed or instructed or advised pilots to block out on the scheduled time, right? You don't dispute that?
I do. I dispute the characterization that what took place was actually a slowdown.
Okay, there was a campaign and the union said that. All right.
Your Honor.
Yeah, the statistics that are cited say that before February 2016, nearly 80% of Atlas flights blocked out prior to their scheduled departure time. After February, only approximately 34% blocked out prior to their scheduled departure time. Do you see the connection? What is wrong? Where's the mistake in that?
Well, the mistake is because I consider it to be, on behalf of my client as well, it's either Orwellian or Kafkaesque to say that we departed early, less early than we did previously. This is not a case where we left after even the estimated time of departure. This is a case where, and I apologize for the time, but this is a case where we left less early. It's the same as when they talk about in the communications of shop. It does remind me very much of Kafka or Orwell. How is it that I'm subject now to contempt with an injunction hanging over my client's head on just simply because of an educational program doing less for a company?
Yeah,
that's not a status quo. I can't find a status quo within there.
The injunction as to the union is simply stop advising the pilots to change the situation that existed before February 2016. Isn't that it?
No, I think that the danger that if this decision stands, the danger is that any creative counsel and along with very creative statisticians can take our pre-section 6 behavior, concerted behavior in enforcing and just doing our collective bargaining enforcement can be deemed to be obstructing carrier's operations.
The aha, as Judge Edwards called here, is important in the district court's reasoning, and I think it starts. Let me just read to you one of the ahas, okay? Atlas executives believe that if they can delay a new CBA long enough, you will lose your interest and your resolve and start violating the CBA, cutting corners and resign yourself to the status quo and abandon the quest for an industry-leading CBA. Well, this cannot be allowed to be the case. You must shop, boot, and push back on all their tactics harder than ever, as we are starting, we desire. That's a call to action, right? It was a call to action by the members. Now, the question is, did they respond? And you're saying they didn't respond?
They responded to a call to action to make sure to know your contract, enforce today's contract, not to influence tomorrow's contract, but today's. It's an
We are starting to get the movement out of this company we desire. So what's the district court judge, who's the fact finder, what's he supposed to do with language like that? Disregard it?
No, what we had asked him to do was, we didn't run away from those communications, if we even could, we didn't anyway, is because he should have taken into consideration the context in which all of that arose. Those programs, those communications dealt with something that had been agreed, that both parties knew as early as January of 2015, long before we filed a Section 6 notice, that dealt with what Captain Kirshner had called a bilateral policy of strict compliance on both sides, because it dealt with the carrier or the union's concerns that the carrier was frankly running roughshod, continuing to violate, and specifically with respect to that quote, making special deals with our individual pilots.
You're saying a call to action to do that which you're lawfully permitted to do and contractually permitted to do doesn't fit the legal prescription. In other words, there can be a call to action, you're saying. But on the blocking, it's a call to action to do what is perfectly permissible because there's no rule that requires you to leave before the starting time. That's your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. In a nutshell, that is correct.
Is that also true with respect to last-minute sick calls?
Yeah, I mean, last-minute sick call is something that was invented for purpose of the litigation that they brought against this case. But again, there's no metric for last-minute sick call, nor is there any communication even in this record or anywhere else that says that you must wait until the last second to call off sick. What was instead litigated in the beginning through its complaint was that the pilots had abused sick calls, period, and then they made up, they called it abuse, and they said then they waited until the last second. Well, the examples of abuse, as we discussed with Judge Edwards, were each and every one were refuted, and the company recognized and conceded that. So it was a made-up metric because they couldn't determine that overall a true sick leave abuse like we've seen in other cases this doesn't exist statistically or otherwise, not even statistically in this case. So they had the jury rig, they had to kind of reverse engineer statistics to try to show a case that doesn't exist legally because there was no status quo.
So we're reviewing
violent.
The district court's injunction here, right? And the district court determined that there was a link between the call to action and this conduct, right? And how are we to review that finding?
It's
a clear error, right?
No, I don't, because I think it has to go back to the abuse of discretion because of the misapplication of the shoreline. The judge's findings were based upon an incorrect application of the RLA and the shoreline and its progeny with respect to what is a status quo. And I think everything that flowed from that was an abuse of discretion. So
you're more or less acknowledging the judge's findings as saying, yeah, there may have been a link, but it's irrelevant because there's no change in the status quo. Yes, there may have been suggestions to the union. You know, under the law, federal regulations, and under the contracts, you don't have to leave before departure time. And there's no company rule that says you do. So you're saying the call to action, district court was right. Maybe there was a call to action, but so what is what you're arguing, as I understand you.
Your Honor, that's correct, but I'm wrestling with trying to respond to Judge Griffith, and that has to do with the fact that the link to to try to influence, the Section 6 negotiation as well. There is no link there. The link, the reason, if you will, behind that dealt with trying to enforce today's collective agreement. There are so many repeated, the whole tapestry, a 19-month effort to put that case together before they dropped it on us in an emergency hearing. It was very cleverly done, but it also very cleverly concealed the fact that they didn't have a status quo to start with. That was only one of many problems. There were several others, as we point out in our papers, but the one other one, again, is at the back end of that analysis again. Even if you made both those connections, at the end of the day, there was no discernible harm.
This, the, the term status quo, does the status quo under the Railway Labor Act take into account what we used to call the law of the shop? And in other words, you go to any plant, any manufacturing facility, any service facility or whatever, and there's certain practices that grow up over time, and they're not spelled out in the collective bargaining agreement. There's tacit approval. Sometimes there's explicit approval. And eventually, the law of the shop develops, almost like a common law. As a matter of fact, when I worked for General Motors, retired Justice Whitaker was the arbitrator or whatever, and it was all this common law in the factories and so on and so forth. Does the Railway Labor Act take that into account as status quo?
It does, but the operative term in your question was certain past practices, not all past practices. I think this court itself in Eastern Airlines pointed out, and as the I believe the Eighth Circuit in the UTU case also pointed out, not every past practice actually rises to the level of becoming a well-established past practice within the meaning both statutes, whether you're under the NLRA or whether you're under the RLA. And when we're here under the RLA, when we're dealing with Section 2 first, we're, again, not dealing with a claim of a specific term in the collective agreement, and that is where you're going, I believe, Your Honor, towards a past practice. If the practice or condition about which we're discussing is a well-established past practice, in other words, is it an objective, actual working condition that's measurable based upon mutual knowledge, consent, if you will, acquiescence, and of long duration, that can rise to, rise to the level of a past practice.
You're saying the district court made no such finding.
That's correct. I think that the district court incorrectly adopted.
Didn't explain what the past practice was, because certainly a past practice could give rise.
Your
argument is the district court never defined what the past practice was in the first place.
That's correct. To the extent that the district court, if you will, purported to define one, it was based upon such vague. It didn't meet the standard under Shoreline to determine whether it was a well-established practice, one that actually attaches to Section 2 first and to the status quo obligation under the statute.
If the company had, during this period, introduced or announced, from here on in, we have a policy that you have to block, you have to get out of the gates, and gave a list of rules before the starting time, here's when you should leave. You don't have discretion. You've got to do it. Is that a major or minor dispute?
If they enacted a policy
as to when the pilots had to leave the gate,
I'd have to follow that policy. And if I didn't, I think they would.
Is that a major or minor dispute? It's new. It's never been there before.
That's part
of what you're arguing. There was no policy.
There was none.
But the company puts a policy in place.
After Section 6?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor, but after or before Section 6?
In the same time period in which we're talking about now.
Then, no, that wouldn't work, because it's a new policy that it's changing, frankly, our discretion. I don't think that would work either, right?
So you're saying that would be a major dispute?
Yeah, because there would have been no status quo from which to measure it from pre-Section 6. In this case, the behavior is really what I think confused the trial court. The behavior alone, again, does not a past practice make within the meaning of this statute or the NLRA. And so, Your Honor, we have, again, I know I've greatly exceeded our time. I would still, if it's possible, like to reserve 2 minutes. That's up to the court's discretion. One other point. Whatever, I know it's almost like stands out like a wholly different one, like a sore thumb, but I also have to tell you, I believe very strongly that the court misapplied the Norris LaGuardia Act, Section 7E. And it did so based upon, a misreading of this court's decision in the Green case, the 1941 decision. It's a case that I believe Judge Edwards was actually the judge in that one, in the Amoeba case. The Crest Tankers case actually cites with authority. And the misapplication of the misreading of that statute was that, there was a belief that actually that was a violence case that would therefore have triggered Section 7E. If you read that case more carefully, the 41 decision from Green, and I think it's on page 53, you will find that the alleged violence that was being discussed there was violence that took place 4 years before the complaint even issued, initiated that case. And the MEBA, the Chris Tankers case, cites the Green case with authority.
We're going to give you a couple minutes.
I'm sorry, but thank you, Your Honor.
Great. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Good morning. Robert Siegel for Atlas Air. Let me, if I might, Your Honors, go right at this issue. First of all, the district court correctly determined that the union had issued a call to arms to slow down pilot behavior, to slow down and disrupt the operation in commerce for the purpose of imposing leverage during a major dispute over the negotiation of a collective bargaining agreement. The district court correctly determined that when a union issues a call to arms for pilots to change their behavior in a manner that slows down, disrupts commerce and operations for the purpose of impacting a major dispute, that is a violation of Section 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act.
Counsel, let me stop you here, because it's not nuanced enough. I mean, I hear you, and it sounds impressive, but there's more to it. If there's a call to action to act within permissible, lawful limits, and the call to action is to do something that's not inconsistent with a known status quo, I don't know how you get to where you want to get. You're ignoring the status quo question. And when I look at these, quite apart from the overtime question, where I can't comprehend your case at all because the circumstances have changed. Your case seems ridiculous to me, to be very honest with you, on the overtime, because the circumstances completely changed. You can't measure them by raw numbers. But in any event, I don't understand your argument to go as far as it has to go to deal with they acted within permissible limits. There was nothing that they did that was inconsistent with contractual or legal limits, and there's nothing to show that what they did was inconsistent with the status quo.
Your Honor, I disagree, if I might please. First of all, the controlling authorities in this case are many over the last quarter century. These facts in this case are not unique.
Come on, tell me about the status quo.
All right, I will, if I might, Your Honor. I want to reference the cases under Section 2 first. And then I'll discuss.
Is the status quo relevant or not?
Pardon me?
Is the status quo relevant?
What is relevant is the implied status quo under 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act, if I might. That is different from Section 6 status quo discussed in the Shoreline case that Mr. Gleason just cited to you. Shoreline did not involve a slowdown and disruption of operations in violation of 2-1. The question there was whether a employer may change work assignments consistent with the Section 6 status quo against employers changing terms and conditions of employment without the Section 6 process. That's not our case. Our case is a different one. It does not involve Section 6 of the Railway Labor Act and the status quo thereunder. What it involves is Section 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act. Section 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act, according to the Supreme Court, has an implied status quo content to it, but it is not one of the status quo provisions in the Railway Labor Act.
You've taken 2 minutes to agree with me that status quo is relevant.
The status quo is relevant. If I might, Your Honor, I agree that the status quo under Section 2-1 has been identified and has been described by the Seventh Circuit in two cases in the last few years. One is United versus IAM, and one is United versus ALPA. It's been described in great detail by the Eleventh Circuit in Delta versus ALPA. It's been decided in recent years in the district court in Charlotte and in Fort Lauderdale recently, where there was a refusal at Spirit Airlines for pilots to accept open time, and it caused 20,000 passengers to be grounded. And the court had no problem in saying, all these courts have said the same thing consistently, that what you do is look at the point of whether or not there has been a change in pre-slowdown behavior, a change before the union issued its call to arms. That's what the status quo is. The courts have regularly looked to see if there has been a change in behavior that violates 2-1, which says you are to make and maintain agreements in a manner that avoids disruption to commerce and to operations arising out of any dispute. So the Seventh Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, The most recently, the district court in Fort
Lauderdale. What was the status quo with respect to blocking?
Okay, the status quo, Your
and
Honor.
Where did the district court make a finding with respect to
the status quo in that situation was demonstrated vividly by a chart offered by Dr. Lee, and Judge Moss actually adopted that chart in his decision. And what it showed is until the union issued a call to arms to stop doing what they had been doing, which was to leave when ready, there was a what Dr. Lee called a statistically significant change in pilot behavior that he had not observed at such an extreme level in 25 years of testifying in cases like this. They were obeying the union, and the union threatened them if they would not obey.
So you're saying the district court found that, as a matter of regular routine, pilots understood they had to leave when ready?
As a matter of regular, I can't tell you what pilots understand in their minds.
I
can tell you as a matter of.
I'm asking you to explain what your argument is.
What the argument was. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to understand what your argument is on status quo. That pilots knew that they had, you're saying, I'm asking, they had to leave when ready. And they had no discretion, is what you're saying.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the pilots demonstrably, on a statistically verified basis, left prior to estimated departure time at a marked level and a demonstrable level. And when the union issued its call to arms, the pilot behavior changed by a dramatic percentage, where all of a sudden, instead of normal practice, pre-slowdown, pre-call of arms. This
That's
has nothing.
You're skipping around. What is the normal practice?
That
you will always leave when ready. Is that the normal practice?
No, I didn't say always, Your Honor. I said that the statistics show
what
that
are the exceptions?
Before the call
what are the
of
exceptions
arms,
to always?
There was not, Your Honor, it was not.
See, the numbers don't make a. If you want to play the numbers game, they don't make a lot of sense. Unless you know what the exceptions were under the existing practice to know whether or not those exceptions came into play here. I don't understand the numbers.
Well, first of all, with all respect, Judge Edwards, I'm not, in my view, playing a numbers game. I'm citing to the kind of evidence that several courts, including the Seventh Circuit and Eleventh Circuit, have relied upon for the last quarter century to determine a change in pilot behavior. It is not grounded on a requirement in the contract about whether you go early or not. It is grounded on.
All
a,
right.
On
so
a,
let me put it this way: in the evidence in the record, the other side introduced evidence that among the things that they took into account were folks sitting in the cockpit, what their time requirements were, and whether leaving at a certain time would adversely affect them. Was that taken into account in the figures?
Judge Moss found that to not be credible, and the reason
was not credible. That was not an accurate
description. What Your Honor just said. He found that the cause of the change in pilot behavior was exactly traced to the call in arms. The union didn't just ask; they directed pilots to stop shop, stop helping out purchase, stop your normal behavior, to boot, which is to block out only on time. These were changes in behavior, Your Honor. This is the change in status quo that the courts, all courts, have recognized under Section 2(1) of the Railway Labor Act. And it's demonstrable. The explanations offered at trial were rejected by the trial judge as not being credible, that the cause of the change, first of all, it's pretty plain. It all started with the call of arms. So the union says, this is what you must do, and by the way, we're going to put notice out that you're a scab if you don't do what we say. And then they do one other thing, Judge Edwards. They say, and we want you to do this because we want you to bring the company to its knees at the negotiating table.
No question that
that's
you
a
have
violation.
Call to arms evidence.
All
right, so I understand your argument on blocking. Let's go to the overtime, which I don't understand
all right,
at all.
All right, if I might. This is a subject addressed by the Seventh Circuit in United versus Alpha. It's addressed by the 11th Circuit in Delta versus Alpha. It's addressed just recently in the district court in Fort Lauderdale in Spirit versus Alpha. Here's what they do. The airlines have a system whereby a certain percentage of their flights are covered by what they call open-time flying. The unions like it. They bargain for it because they get premium pay.
Right.
The airlines staff their operations accordingly. This is all discussed in the 11th Circuit opinion, and I recommend the decision to you. But what they say is you have a status quo that involves an arrangement whereby there's a normal pattern, not required pilot by pilot. The courts have addressed this. But there is a pattern by which a certain percentage of the flights are picked up.
In those cases, did we have situations that were the same as the one here, which was the companies changed what they were offering in terms of overtime? I mean, the evidence is very strong here. No. You can't use the numbers to measure they're two different scenarios. The union's argument and evidence here is very compelling. That the reason there was a drop, let me tell you the two pieces of evidence that were at least compelling to me when I looked at them. The reason you had a drop, and it wasn't consistently a drop because it went down, came back up again, and then it wavered. So there was no consistent drop. But the problem was, starting out, what the company was offering in terms of overtime changed, and it was not desirable. Now, they aren't required to take bad overtime, and they're required to take any of it. So you can't say there's a change in the status quo when what these pilots were being offered changed.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, that's a factual argument made at trial. Judge Moss found that the explanation offered by the union was not credible.
And he may be clearly erroneous because the evidence that was offered by the union, let me make sure we're together on this because this one left me cold. Judge Moss did not say, as I recall, that the union was wrong in saying that the offerings of overtime had changed. He did not say that. The other thing he did not say was that, indeed, the overtime figures went up and down. And in one month, which was a high-fly month, they did not go down. So I don't know what you end up with. Judge Moss did not side with you. He simply elided the arguments that were made.
No, Your Honor, my perspective is on the issue of changing behavior on open time flying. Judge Moss, first of all, used the same analysis that the 11th Circuit and the 7th
Circuit
used.
It's not the same circumstances.
Your Honor, with all respect, the union openly told the pilots to stop picking up open time in order to cause delay, disrupt operations, disrupt commerce, and to do so to bring the company to its knees and collective bargaining.
The problem is you have numbers that are completely inconsistent with that.
Well, the statistical report, with all respect, Your Honor, Dr. Lee's report showed that there was a statistically significant change. He uses a standard deviation analysis. All the courts have accepted that as evidence of concerted action to change behavior in order to impose leverage in collective bargaining during a major dispute. Your Honor, if I can just say this, from a practical matter, as I have my dialogue with your Honor, this is a real-world situation for the airlines. What we are talking about is whether or not an airline's operation and U.S. commerce can, under whatever arguments are being made here, be disrupted purposely and at the call of arms of a union so that the union can achieve what it thinks is leverage in collective bargaining. And the people who suffer, if the union is allowed to do that and to essentially ignore the restrictions of Section 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act, which requires it to make and maintain agreements without that kind of disruption, who suffers is, first of all, as Your Honor would well know, the public suffers. That's the whole purpose of Section 2-1 of the Railway Labor Act.
I'm not doubting your concerns. I'm trying to understand the case. And on the overtime, I don't get it at all because the district court's findings simply are not supported as far as I can see. The blocking, I hear what your argument is. Suppose this had happened and there was no call to arms on the blocking. That is, in fact, the numbers, as you say, went down. There was no call to arms. Union officials said nothing. Would the case be different?
First of all, the case law says the union, even if it doesn't instigate the slowdown, has an absolute obligation to take effective steps to stop it. So if it were instigated by a rump group, this is directly affirmed in the Seventh Circuit opinion.
All right, so you're saying if the facts in this case were blocking, is there are no rules with regard to when you have to leave other than on time. The union has made no call to arms. They've instigated nothing. They've said nothing. Called no action, but the numbers start changing. Sure. You could get an injunction?
First of all, Your Honor, obviously that's not this case. Okay, but
I understand it's not this case.
In Delta versus
hypothetical.
Your Honor?
Tell me, could you get an injunction?
The two circuits have said yes because it is their interpretation of two first, that the union has, as the certified representative, an obligation to take effective steps to stop an illegal slowdown disrupting operations.
No, I don't know what you mean by illegal. That's the problem we keep going around. There's no requirement that you leave in a certain way. The company has no rules. The federal regs certainly don't require it. The pilots have discretion. That's where your case is. There are no requirements.
With all due respect, Judge Edwards, I think that is not the interpretation, that is not the rule that has developed over the last quarter century in the cases. They do not require that the behavior that we're focused on be required by a rule. That's just something being up right now in this case.
You're missing my point, but I won't waste your time.
All right, but Your Honor, with all respect, I think it is important for this for the panel to understand that the issue here, including the open time issue, which has been addressed in all the other prior cases, does involve a situation where in this case the union was telling the pilots to change their pre-slowdown behavior and telling them exactly why, so that you will.
Okay, you made that point. What about on the last category?
Before you get to that last category, would you clear something up for me with respect to the overtime? I guess the counter argument is that there was really no change. The Section 6 notice came in February of 2016, and there really was no change until September. But I don't know whether it's disputed that there was a change that occurred from September on, but the statistics indicate there was a dramatic change. So the only question was whether the union was responsible for that change.
Yeah.
Which is a factual question that Judge Moss resolved in against the union.
That's
and said,
correct.
Yes, they were responsible.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And when Judge Moss did that, he pointed out that when the Section 6 notice is served, it's not necessarily an automatic start button for all activity. The union intensified its communication plan when the Section 6 notice was served. And you watch the intensification of the communications, and then you watch the intensification of the impact on the operation and the change in pilot behavior. And he says he found as a matter of credibility of the witnesses and the evidence that therefore there can be a intensification of the problem sometime after the Section 6 notice.
Okay, thank you.
In further answer to that question, I will have to go back and look at the numbers again. My recollection is it's an exaggeration to say there was a dramatic change in the overtime post-September. It went up and down and went back down again in November. It wasn't consistent. There was no straight line the wrong way.
Doctor,
you're not telling the truth the figures. There was not a consistently dramatic change post-September. That's not correct.
Well,
they went up and down, and November they went the wrong way, inconsistent with your case.
First of all, the changes were, I can't argue back and forth on the subject other than saying
it was,
there was an expert.
Wait, counsel, wait, this is an important fact. You said to Judge Randolph, right, there was a dramatic, consistent dramatic change. That's not correct.
That's what was demonstrated by Dr. Lee's expert report. What he does, he's a recognized expert on the airline industry and statistics, and he's a PhD in economics. And what he does is a study. He first of all does a regression analysis to rule out other factors. And then he concludes on a standard deviation basis that there is in fact what he calls a statistically significant change.
And what did he say about the change in the offering? That is the overtime that was being offered. It went down dramatically and it was different, right?
Your Honor, you'll see in the opinion, he did a regression analysis to control for that factor and every other factor. The judge found his testimony to be credible. And it was not rebutted at trial by anything offered by the union. I'd like to stress that while, if I could, just to conclude, while we quibble over some of this, the question that is in front of us is again, when the two parties are undoubtedly involved in what the courts have called a major dispute over the negotiation of a collective bargaining agreement, may a union do what this union did, which is to issue a call to arms telling pilots to change their behavior in order to disrupt commerce and operations for the purpose of bringing the carrier to its knees in collective bargaining. And under two firsts, Congress has said it may not do so. It may not take action in the making or maintaining of agreements designed to disrupt operation or commerce. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you one thing, counsel. If the company, I'm going to ask you the same thing I asked the other side, if the company during this period had said there's a new policy on blocking, here's what you have to do, is that major or minor dispute?
Well, that's, Your Honor, that's Shoreline, that's Conrail, that's a different situation. When the carrier purports to change and the status quo
just
and issue a new rule.
Do you think it's major or minor?
No, Your Honor, under first of all, it's not a black, if I can please, I know the answer, which is when a carrier takes action to change a term of employment, it is either permitted by an implied or express term of the contract that's applicable.
Major or minor?
Or, Your Honor, it depends on what is in the collective bargaining agreement. Sometimes what employers do are permitted under the terms of a Conrail. Under the terms of a collective bargaining agreement, Conrail announces it's going to start a drug test. And the Supreme Court eventually says Conrail has an arguably justified reason for doing so, go to arbitration, it might be a minor dispute. On the other hand, if Conrail's explanation were deemed frivolous, then it would be a major dispute. That's the test. It was discussed in Shoreline. It was discussed in Conrail by the Supreme Court.
Does it matter under Section 2, first, whether it's major or minor?
Well, that's an excellent question, Your Honor. In this case, it's been assumed that it should be that a two-firsts violation arises out of a major dispute. But in most cases, that's what happens because it occurs during collective bargaining.
Right.
But there are persuasive cases that have said even if the slowdown arises out of a minor dispute, even if it would still be a violation of two-firsts, there's an excellent discussion of that subject in the Seventh Circuit opinion, United versus ALPA, and if you look at the district court opinion, Judge Lefkow, her opinion was adopted by the Seventh Circuit, and she correctly said, actually, it doesn't matter. The union cannot do a call to arms and disrupt operations to try to pressure the carrier, whether it's a major dispute or a minor dispute. It's just that most cases come up in a major dispute. But two-firsts says make or maintain agreements without disruption, not just make. I would also recommend, Your Honor, the cases we cited in the Second Circuit and the Third Circuit who agree with Judge Lefkow and the Seventh Circuit That's Long Island Railroad and SEPTA. In both those cases, they approved Section 2 first injunctions, even though there was an underlying minor dispute that was going to be sent to arbitration.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have your argument. Mr. Gleason, we'll give you back 3 minutes.
Thank you, and I'll try not to use the entire three. I know I used a substantial amount before. What I really wanted to come back up to discuss with your honors are the cases that Mr. Siegel cited. Mr. Siegel cited, really, they came up in a different context than this. In the cases, the United cases, for instance, that was a Section 8 Norris LaGuardia Act clean hands case. It was a Section 8, the second prong as well, that, you know, was it the least restrictive means in order to affect the result that the courts were seeking. That's not a situation where there was a dispute as to what the status quo was. That's markedly different than what we have here. We've disputed quite vigorously that the Judge Moss did not make findings of any Section 2 first status quo practice that could arises that could be deemed to be the status quo. And so I would commend and then ask that your honors make sure I'm right. I think I am. I don't think that those cases arose within the context in which we're here today. Mr. Siegel, I know, was going down a path about major and minor disputes as well in terms of calls to arms and slowdowns and all that. I would also ask your honors to take a look at the Sixth Circuit's, what I call, I guess the circuit does too, the ABEX 1 case that was, I would ask you to read that. That case arose not during the Section 6 period. There was a more recent decision. Oh my goodness, it was, I think, decided Election Day a year, maybe 2 years, 2 years ago, and also in the by Judge Black in Cincinnati, also within the Sixth Circuit, of course, dismissing claims of violations of a Section 2 first status quo. I just think that one of the things that comes out of this discussion, this dialogue with your honors today, is that just how impermissible and inappropriate it is to hinge findings, clear proof findings, of union participation and calling to arms of a labor dispute on statistics. Unlike the Kettle case, I don't say that statistics don't have any use, and I don't think the court has done that yet in the analysis. But unlike the other cases that Mr. Siegel cites, the statistics were designed to, if you will, to substantiate real hard evidence of violations. Now, again, the unfortunate situation here is we are fighting and disputing the existence even of a status quo to which they could enjoin. Elsewhere, that was just conceded. But to use statistics to try to prove not just clear proof union participation to get past Section 6 Norris LaGuardia Act is very troublesome. This was a case where the statistics drove the entire analysis, and that was a misapplication of the law. Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, I would like to thank you, and I think you have the case.
The case is submitted.
Stand, please.